As you peer around your tiny cubicle, look carefully, look closely at the way the draperies hang behind you. Are you casting a long shadow, friend? Are you astride your world like some 20th century giant? Do you hold down the fort with the aplomb of a man worthy of that deep, rich, bounteous soul with which you have been bequeathed? Are you, eh? I'm sure. Like all of us there, Kingfish. Like every last one of us. I'll award you the brass figligee with bronze oak leaf palm if you can tell me the name of the Kingfish's wife. That's right, Kingfish. In fact, I remember one time, one of the great thrills, speaking of Kingfish, one of the great thrills of my amateur radio career, that's as opposed to the amateur radio career that I get paid miserly for, as opposed to that career, I have a career as an amateur radio operator. And one of the great thrills of my early hamming came one time when I was on the middle of in the afternoon, just sitting there talking away to some guy, way out on the West Coast somewhere, and it turned out to be one of the Amos and Andy duo. Yeah, one of them was a ham. Still is, far as I know. And I'll award you a brass figligee if you can tell me the name of the lawyer in that cast. You remember that? Come on. He'd talk like this. He'd say, Now look, Kingfish. Brother Kingfish, you're just going to have to do something about this. I'm not going to stand by and let you do that because I's a lawyer. And let me tell you, we lawyers know what can be done and what can't be done. I'm just not going to stand by for this. Now, who is that? His name was Brother Crawford. Who used to go, awa, awa, awa. He made that famous, that phrase famous. Which one of them did that? Well, you know, a funny thing, I've got a collection of old records that go back to the days before Amos and Andy really made it, you know, the records that I picked up in the Salvation Army and all that sort of thing. And I have a record that was made before they were called Amos and Andy. What were they called then? Well, now, this is quite a famous incident in radio. They were called something else, and they were broadcasting on a local radio station in Chicago. And, they were a fantastic hit in Chicago. They were local guys, you know. Their show was local. And they were a big success. And one day, they went network. And because they went network, the local radio station was so mad. It says, you can't use that name. We own that name. We own the name of that radio show. And they had to invent a new name, and it became Amos and Andy. And they invented it the very night they went on the air for the first time on the network. They were in an elevator. This is a famous story. Whether it's apocryphal or not, I don't know. But they were in an elevator going on up to do their first network broadcast. And they were really in a sweat because they had been told about an hour before they could not use the name that they had made famous. And they didn't know what to call our show. Here they were all of a sudden going on the network. They had no name, you know. Just like if all of a sudden somebody says, you're not Arthur Godfrey now anymore. You're going to go on 10 minutes. What are you going to be? And so they're riding up the elevator, and one of the guy that's running the elevator's name was Andy. And they knew him, and they said, hi, Andy. And he says, hi. And they said, gee, what's your name? And they had to get a name that rhymed somehow with Andy. Somebody says, let's use the name Andy. Andy, you be Andy. And the other one said, Andy, we've got to get another name. And somebody says, well, let's see, how about Amos? Amos and Andy. And he said, well, all right, it's okay. We'll use it for a while anyway. And that became a famous name. What was the other name? Yeah, the other name was terrific. And you know that they reversed their roles? That was the curious thing about it, that the record that I have, the roles are exactly reversed. By this, I mean, if you recall Amos and Andy at all, you remember that Amos was the level-headed guy. He was the guy that was the reliable guy. What was the name of his girlfriend? Don't you remember Ruby? That's a famous girlfriend. What was Andy's girlfriend's name? He said, well, Brother Crawford, I'm going over to see Madam Queen tonight. Madam Queen. And his girlfriend was Madam Queen, and they the roles of the two of them were roughly this. Amos was the level-headed guy. He was the guy that was always trying to straighten things out. He had the good sense, and Amos, on the other hand, or Andy, on the other hand, he was a big old, he says, buzz me, Miss Brown, buzz me. Remember when they had Miss Brown? Buzz me, Miss Brown. Hey, Amos, I'm going over to the lodge, and I'm going to see the kingfish over there today, and I'm going to tell him I'm going to say kingfish. Yeah, remember? Yeah, King, what was the name of their lodge? That was a great lodge, I'll tell you. And why was the kingfish called the kingfish? Well, he was the kingfish. That was the head guy of the lodge. And so he always was the kingfish, that's all. Now, in the early record that I have, they are exactly the reverse. Andy is the solid, reliable one, and Amos is completely, he's completely a kook, you know. He's a real scatterbrain type. And Andy's saying, now look here, Amos. We just can't have you run around like that. Well, now you sit down here and listen to me, and I'll pound some sense into your head. And he was a total reversal of what the eventual role turned out to be. And what was their name? I won't even tell you this. It's a very famous. If you don't think this was a historical thing in radio, at one point, before we go any further, speaking of radio history, I will give you a brass figlegee if you will tell me the name of their announcer, who became famous all over the country, and he was always with them on their famous radio show. And he used to come on, and they'd do the commercial, and he would come in and do it. And what was their sponsor? And speaking of sponsors, friends, and they'd come on, oh, wow, this announcer became very, very famous, doing just the Amos and Andy show. Now, one more question about Amos. Do you know that, do you really know, do you, it's hard to believe the kind of impact that a radio show can have on the people of a time. I don't think there's ever been anything, at least in the history of modern communications in the United States, that even remotely approached the sort of grip that Amos and Andy had on the population at one point in time. I doubt whether anything ever again will ever achieve that, because, of course, they came at the time when radio communication was a comparatively new thing, and they built such complete rounded characters and built such a series of peculiar situations in their scripts and so on that it gripped the entire people of the United, everybody, the entire nation, in a vice that was almost unbreakable at one point. Do you know that at one point, according to contemporary accounts, movie houses used to stop everything in the middle of their program and put a radio on the stage to listen to Amos and Andy? And nobody would go to the movie house unless they did it. People said, they can't miss this episode. They just can't miss what's happening. And they came on at night. They were on about 10:15, I think, in Chicago, something like that. So it was right in the middle of, you know, if you're going to go to a show, this is right in the middle of that time. And so whenever there was any question, any big event happening on Amos and Andy, all the theaters would have out in front of their marquee, they would say, Amos and Andy at 10:15 on the stage. Meaning that you don't have to miss it. And so people would come in, they'd see Johnny Weissmuller, and you know, they'd sit there for a while. And then when Johnny quit swinging, they up would go the lights, and at 10:15, on would come the radio on the stage. Everyone would sit in the audience. The whole audience would sit there and listen to Amos and Andy and cheer and laugh and whatever it is. And then Amos and Andy would go off, and on would come the movie again. Well, there was one famous situation in Amos and Andy that grew to such an extent, it got to people so deeply involved, that Congress was having a late night session. They were having a big thing where there were 24 hours, you know, how they go along. They were trying to pass a law, get a bill through, a budget law, and they had to stop everything in Congress one night. They had to absolutely stop everything. Filibustering, yelling, campaigning, pork barreling, the whole thing stopped for that 15 minutes when they trotted a radio out and all the senators and the vice president and everybody could sit and listen to Amos and Andy. How's that for fantastic success? Unbelievable. You can't imagine the Senate stopping to watch Beverly Hillbillies. You just can't imagine the halls of Congress grinding to a halt to watch Ben Casey. You know, and yet that's what they did. Now, I will. Do you remember what the incident was about? Any of you know anything about it? That was a wild incident when Amos's girlfriend was in the hospital and it looked like she was not going to live. That's what it was about. And they were having the big night when the crisis was arriving at the point, you know, and the music would come on. And they'd say, as we drop into Amos and Andy's office, what was the name of their office? Come on. What business were they in? Oh, for heaven's sakes. That was famous. As a matter of fact, I had a toy when I was a kid. I had a toy that was a copy of their business. Don't put that up yet, Mike. No. It was a copy of their business. It was a toy, and I wish I had it today because it would be worth considerable money on the collector's market, you know, the market of Americana is about what you can call it. And it was a toy that was a copy, and it worked. You'd wind it up, and it would go, and it had Amos and Andy in it. It would go, and it made sounds, and it would buck and wiggle and make sparks and everything else. And I was given this for one Christmas. It was a toy based on the business that Amos and Andy were in. Now, what was their business? You mean you don't remember the Fresh Air Taxi Cab Company? The Fresh Air Taxi Cab Company, meaning that they had a Model T taxi that had no top on it. And it was the Fresh Air Taxi Cab Company. And I had that beautiful toy. I remember it now. It was all, you know, colored and all that. And one of the very few times that I can recall real excitement around the house was one time when I was taken with a couple of other kids in the neighborhood by one of the neighborhood ladies. One of the mother types was designated to take this group of kids to the show on a Saturday afternoon to see a famous movie that stopped the entire Western world. And it was an Amos and Andy movie. Did you know they made movies? Sure. And Amos and Andy made this fantastic movie. They came out with comic strips and comic books and the whole business. They were really, and yet very few people remember their original name, which was not Amos and Andy. Well, there were a lot of things around at that time that had a strange effect on people. I'll award you, bring that up. What was this theme song? Exactly like this. This is the way they played it. This is a famous theme song on radio. And my mother used to sit there, and the instant this came on, her eyes would puddle up. Her bathrobe would get damp from tears. And she'd sit there huddled in front of the cross like... And the announcer would say, and now we take you to that little house halfway up in the next block. Yeah. You don't know that one, huh? Oh, I'm pulling rank here on everybody. But what's that? Yeah, stick that up there. That was a famous theme song, and that particular show was the forerunner of a gigantic, or at least one of the forerunners, of an entire radio form. It was the beginning of a whole avalanche of things which later became a commonplace, and to this day, its type, the thing that it created, is still on television. And I remember every boy used to come on there, and we'd sit there. Of course, I didn't listen. I was too small. I was not involved in it. I just remember that theme song. Da, 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 la, da, 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 la, da, da, da. Now, radio has had a profound impact on people, and I don't think it is yet really been totally analyzed. I don't think it's been completely digested, even by the most important of sociologists. Speaking of your digestive tract, I think it's about time for a commercial. You know, another broadcast that when I was just a kid, another broadcast that completely dominated at least our house, and I know that many other houses around us. Now, we came from a neighborhood. This is northern Indiana, Chicago, the Midwest. There was nothing there that would even remotely approach what we today call culture. There was no little theater movement. Well, there was. I mean, we had a toothpaste pageant as I was in second grade. I played a toothbrush. That was the theater in our town. And I remember Dawn Strickland played this mouthwash. And it was an oral hygiene pageant. It was very excellent, well done. I one time played a turkey, too, in Thanksgiving. Of course, I've played in a lot of turkey since then, but I played a turkey then, and I had feathers sticking out in the back and a big thing on the top of the head, and I was a turkey. I was sacrificed in the middle of the first scene there, but I died gracefully. Of course, my chief theatrical achievement at that time was the portrayal, which was magnificent, of George Washington. I played George Washington once in a George Washington birthday play, and I understood, of course, I don't like to brag, but there was not a dry eye in the PTA house that night. And I sat there in a rocking chair and rocked back and forth, and I had a white wig on the top of my head. I was about, I was in third grade. I had black patent leather shoes with with tin foil buckles, and this was the theater in our town. But there was a radio show that came on. It would come on and it'd just take over the whole town. Absolutely. You can't believe it. And my mother used to walk around in the kitchen, and somehow this meant New York. It meant an escape from the steel mills. It meant an escape from the stockyards, from my old man, the whole scene. And it would just come bellowing out of that radio. The old radio hopping up and down on top of the icebox. My mother bending over the sink with her Brillo pad, and this stuff would come roaring out, rattling the windows. A little old Crosley, its speaker cone being torn to bits, and this would come booming out. Oh, man, listen. Holy smokes. And she would stand there staring out over the backyards. The tangled backyards of the Midwest, crisscrossed by a thousand clotheslines of the past, clothes poles akimbo, the dark shadows laying over the alleys, Mr. Bruner staggering up the driveway drunker than a coot, the smoke rising from the blast furnace, and the sound would roar out of the Crosley. Yeah. Now, what was that? It's still on. The oldest single long-lived radio program in the history of the radio world. It is still on the air. The Saturday afternoon opera broadcast. Of course. My mother knew nothing about opera. Had never, to my knowledge, even to this day, has never been to an opera. Never been to an opera. I'm telling you, this is a fact. She knew nothing. She did not know any of the languages. They did not know any of the operas. Didn't know the names of them. Didn't know the people. She was not listening because they said, well, so-and-so is going to be singing today. So-and-so is conducting. She didn't know the names of the conductors. And Milton Cross would come on. And it was all Greek to her. I know this for a fact. Will be Rigoletto. You know how he always talks, Rigoletto, conducted by Fausto Cleva. This afternoon, the role of Minetta will be sung by... And all my mother would hear would be the sound of this gigantic opera broadcast booming out all over the world. What it meant to her, I don't know. She did not come from a musical family. Nobody did in that neighborhood. Their idea of big music was Gene Autry. Yeah, he sang through his nose. Played the guitar with his ear. This would just take him. There was, now, I'm telling you the truth. To me, this was pure art loving, pure art appreciation. You agree with me, Mike? It was just for its own sake entirely. And she never missed it. The opera broadcast was absolutely the one broadcast, the one radio show that runs through my entire early life like a thread. And a peculiar thing about that, it meant a lot of things to my mother. I know that it meant a lot of things to the people out there, probably far more to the people there than it means to the people in the East or wherever it is that the opera always came from. Of course, it came from the Met. And it meant to her New York. It meant, it meant that whole world out there. It meant another kind of life, totally. And she didn't really know it. She never could articulate it and say, you know, what that means is another way of life. You know? Nothing like that. It was just like an animal somehow who senses that there's something on the other side of the river. And that opera broadcast, and I maintain probably to this very day, there are people on farms way out in Iowa, people way out in Utah someplace. You can name all the shows you want. I don't care what they are. You can name, the nighttime TV shows and all this stuff. They don't mean the same thing. There is a certain kind of peculiar grandeur. There is a certain kind of absolutely inescapable theatricality to the opera broadcast. And I'll never forget the time, and this is by way of personal reminiscences. Before we go any further, I think we ought to take a quickie break here. Now, this kind of this sort of feeling about this thing is very, very subtle. And I remember the time. I don't know whether I never heard anybody talk on the air about the impact that radio shows and so on make upon a specific slice of the population. But I remember one of the great early triumphs, when you talk about early triumphs, one of the great moments of personal triumph that I've ever had was the time I did for two summers, I did the opera commentary on a network from this magnificent place where they did the operas in Cincinnati, the Zoo Opera. They did the Zoo Operas there, and I had a chance to do the opera commentary. And one thing had led to the other. It was just one of those, a series of little circumstances. And the next thing I knew, there I was in a box high overlooking the stage. And down below me was this grand opera cast. Now, this is a real grand opera cast. This is not amateur Knightsville, magnificently done. That blue sky arching overhead, that dark night, rich sky. You could smell the river somewhere off in the distance. You could see 3,000 people downstretched below me. They're all dressed in their summer clothing. I've got this microphone in front of me, and I am attached to 48, at that time, 48 states. And I remember the orchestra beginning its big intro, the overture to Carmen. And I can they play this opening thing, and it's booming all out. And I say, welcome to tonight's broadcast of Carmen. And down below in the pit, Fausto Klever is conducting the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra in the overture to Bizet's opera Carmen. Tonight's cast will feature, oh, what a fantastic feeling. Somehow I knew that minute that I had made the big time. It was the big time. And then the real feeling of achievement, I mean, I can't describe to you how it is Fausto Klever, the conductor. Now get this, Mr. Klever is a famous metropolitan conductor and a man of paralyzing dignity. He is one of these people you can't ever imagine being a kid. Fausto Klever was never a kid. He was never old Fausty down on the corner, nothing like that. I mean, Fausto Klever was born a human glacier, with gray hair, and that steel mane, and fantastic operatic conductor. This guy's is probably one of the best of the operatic conductors in the world today. He's not as well known as other conductors, but among opera people, he's one of the probably three or four greatest. And I am sitting, do you agree, Mike? And I'm sitting there. And by the way, conducting opera is probably the most difficult of all conducting. It just cuts everything. You know, people will get all excited when they see somebody conducting Ravel's La Valse or something. You know, they'll see him waving his arms. But let me tell you, an operatic conductor is a human. He's a true conductor. Yes, sir. He's got everything going. Boy, and they don't use scores. It's just scary. Have you ever seen a backstage conductor? Now, that's another interesting art. The backstage conductor is conducting the choruses and so on, the singing backstage. And you'll hear off in the distance, you know, when you hear... And you hear backstage, you hear the soldiers go... There's a guy backstage there who is plotting, by the way, one day to unseat the guy out in front. And he's got a score ahead of him there, and he's got all these people singing... And the Toreador chorus is booming out. Oh, that's a wild scene, these two conductors working in tandem. They never talk about the backstage conductor. He's a very unknown guy. Usually he is an apprentice conductor, if you can call him that. A few years from then, he will probably conduct an opera. But Fausto Clava, that great moment, reset that, Mike, that great moment. I'm sitting up in my booth, you see. And I'm waiting, and I'm all by myself, and my producer is sitting behind me there, and, you know, the network wire, we're on the big network coast to coast, and I got the cans on, and I hear the network cue come through, and I hear that little boop, you know, that means this is your cue, you go boop, and I sit there for a second, and I look down over the audience, and the engineer brings up the pot, and you, I hear the crowd in my ears, then you see, and it brings up the entire atmosphere. I hear the sound of the stage. You had the mics hanging out over the stage. And I see down below me in the light, the people are all waiting. I see the orchestra prepared. And down below me in the light with the faint amber glow of the splash from the stage playing over his iron gray locks is Fausto Clava. And Fausto Clava has just come into the auditorium. Of course, there's been a big, whoa, there's a big applause, you see. And now he's standing down there at his lectern. And guess to whom he is looking for his cue. That's right. And I am looking down at Fausto Clava, and the audience is sort of looking up at me. The whole opera is waiting, and it is Bizet. And he is standing there waiting. His baton is raised. I nod my head curtly. And out it comes. I have turned it on. I have turned the whole machine on. Backstage Carmen, her eyes flashing, is swirling, preparing to make her entrance. Don Jose is preparing to meet his fate, which we all know is a dastardly one. The bullfighter is putting on his cape. And the whole world of the opera has come to life. And there I am, up in the booth, the god that controlled it all. I look down at Clava. Clava looks up at me. He gives me a curt wave like we're in business. And I look down, fine, it's coming through good. And on comes the Toreador song. Oh, man. What a sense of power. Great moments in in radio. It's a very, you know, I guess a lot of people wonder what the lure of this career is in radio, but there are many things that can't be really discussed because they're very personal. It's a very personal thing, and I remember going backstage a couple of hours later. Before we go any further, how about a commercial here, huh? You don't want to hear the rest of these. You like this operatic thing. Well, do you have, what else do you have in there in the way of, do you have the Pilgrim's Chorus in there? Any of those great classics? I just can't describe to you there you go, boy. That whole season, and we do all these operas, and every week I would do my homework well. I'll tell you, I'd steep myself in the opera and all the people that were working in it. And I remember one night coming backstage, one of the really most impressive figures that I've ever seen in my life, in any operatic, non-operatic life, fantasy, play, any type of experience that I've had that has even the slightest edge of the make-believe to it, I've never seen a character, a person or a man, who was more impressive than this magnificent Basso. This guy, I went backstage one day, and this was about an hour or so before the opera was to begin, and it was Faustus. Now, this is a spectacular opera. It's one of my great favorites because it really allows the lighting man, it allows the costumer, it allows everybody to go hog wild if they desire to go hog wild. It's really a theatrical situation. And it's far more basically theatrical because of the situation involved. You all know the story of Dr. Faustus selling his soul to the devil to become a youth. And here is the girl there and the whole scene. Well, I'm backstage about an hour or so before the opera's to begin. And they have these little cubicle dressing rooms back there. And it's a quiet evening, and the people are kind of swirling around on the outside. You know, they're all kind of peeking in, because the world of the opera singer is a very special world. It's not at all like theater. People keep thinking in terms of, you know, movie stars or even the concert stage. They keep thinking of things like the stage, the Broadway. No, this is a special world. But first of all, they are magnificently talented. There is nobody who sings grand opera who is a phony. I'll tell you, you just don't ad-lib your way through. True, Mike? Well, no, let's face it. Oh, I'm not saying they're all equally talented. But you cannot ad-lib your way through. You just can't. You can't be phonied up by a director, you know, like a movie star can. You can take somebody right off the street and they can make a 2.5-hour movie and get by. Nobody walks out on an operatic stage wearing the robes of Don Jose. He wouldn't last 18 seconds. That's the end of it. Well, one of the most difficult roles in opera is the role of Mephistopheles. Mephistopheles in Faustus. Well, I am backstage walking along, and everybody is all preparing, and I'm walking past this cubicle, and I hear this guy warming up, and he is going, booms out, rock. And I just hear this, and he's then he goes, ha ha ha. He laughs. And the walls shot. I'm walking past. It's like walking past like King Kong is working out in there, you know. And all the little people. This is larger than life, you know. And you always expect the stage somehow to be larger than life, but not the people on it, really. And boom, boom. Well, I knock on the door. I had to see this guy. He says, come in, come in. He had a peculiar kind of an Italian accent. I open the door, and there he is. He is sprawled out. It is the devil. He's got a pointed beard, and he is at least 6'9". What a man. He has got shoulders that are 4.5 feet across. He's got a waist of about 19 inches. Fantastic man, sprawled out there with that red cape, and he just looks at me with burning eyes. He looks up at me. Oh, there's a maniacal quality to opera singers you just can't put down. I'll tell you, they're total nuts. They really are. And he looks up at me. What do you want? You know, what do you want? Well, what do you ask the devil? You know, what do you want? I said, well, I'd like to talk to you for a minute. And he says, come in. And I walk in there, and I sit down next to him. Little tiny figure. I realize all of a sudden a little. And I say, I want to talk to you about this thing. He was coming on in the after the broadcast interview type thing we had. We talked a little bit about it, and I could hear the people all walking around outside. Here's this fantastic, talented guy. And not only Italian, he's an enormous athlete, tremendous athlete. He really was the devil. And so, I mean, you know, superhumanly, you always think of the devil as being able to do everything better than everybody else. And I walk out, and then that night, I'm waiting to see him. I had never seen him work. That night, the scene, you know, you see the old Dr. Faustus walking around on the stage, and you see the whole business of the girl, and he's got the retorts, and he's got the smoke and the steam, and he's in his laboratory there, and it's... I sell my soul to the devil. You hear? And then you see the There's a thunderclap off stage. Another one. The lights dim. Dr. Faustus sinks down to the stage in terror. And then, without any warning, boom! There's a crash of thunder. The red light flickers and dies. Boom! Another one. And rising out of the floor in a puff of smoke is Mephistopheles. 6 feet, 7 feet, 20 feet high he rises, and looks down with his great swirling red cape, his eyes flashing, and the entire audience sort of sank down in their feet. And I says, I know him!
Recita!
Mashallah! Kamala Walter! Kamala! I'm playing the Duke here. See, there, he's singing his famous duet with his manservant, who is about to assassinate the king. I am pleading with him not to go. He is a member of the insurgent peasant band. We are commiserating together now our common fate. Oh, man. You just can't beat it. Yes, sir. If I had it to do all over again, I'd spend my life watching operas and listening to commercials. Yeah, that... You want to hear the rest of that aria? Still, are you? Oh, wow. I'll tell you this about it. As I say, one of the great moments of my entire career came when there I am up there. See, I'm doing my first opera broadcast, and it rolls out. And a couple of hours later, I'm on the phone, and I'm calling back home, and guess who had listened to it? Of course, my mother. See, she's out there, and she heard me on the opera. And there was a hushed quality in her voice. As though somehow, now I was in that other world. And there she was, still back there in the kitchen with the clotheslines, with the sink, with the Brillo pads, with the egg on the lapel of the bathrobe. And somehow I had come out of the radio with all those people, those dukes, those counts, those lords, the devil himself, Mephistopheles, Fausto Cleva, all the great people who live somewhere on a fantastic stage, Siegfried, the Rhine Maidens, Lohengrin, Gotter, Dammerung, it all came rolling out of the Crosley with the cracked plastic case. And there I was with them. I was making comments, calm, easy voice saying, tonight's conductor is Dr. Fausto Cleva. He is now in the pit. Our cast tonight includes Roberta Peters. It includes Nicolola Mosconia. It includes... And she's out there listening to me. And all the while, that great world is booming out, roaring out from all over the continent, all over the universe, everywhere except the backyards of the benighted Midwest, swirling around at Ali Pagliacci. Listen to him. Yeah, this is not Cleveland. That's right. This is not Indianapolis. Yeah, it's a strange fugitive world, and one that is almost impossible to explain. The hunger, the drive, the deep seated urge we have for theatricality just cannot be in any way ignored. It just can't be. We've just got it, and there it is. We're the only animal that has it, and I suppose the most theatrical thing ever created by the mind of man, this side of really monumental architecture, which can be fantastically theatrical. I don't think there's anything any more theatrical that I've ever seen in my own experience than the Great Pyramid at Gizeh. This is an experience that just rock your rabbit, and it is theatricality par. I mean, it goes all the way, absolutely all the way. The next thing I think that has come out of the mind of man, in the world of theater, of course, great religions often can be incredibly theatrical, but there is a parallel. There is a parallel between the theatricality of a religion and the theatricality of the pyramids and the theatricality of grand opera. It is a strange thing. I remember one evening at watching a performance. It just completely transforms the whole world for a moment, and there's no way to explain it. Absolutely no way to explain it. I remember watching a performance of a very unlikely opera. To have this sense of theatricality. And the opera was Lohengrin. Now, Lohengrin is a difficult opera. And it's not, as you know, Mike, it's not the kind of opera, it's not Poplarsville. Yet it is in a strange sort of way. Another time that I've seen this moment of electricity come was in the very opera from which this aria was taken. Yeah, Pagliacci. A strange. It depends. This is an opera that depends almost exclusively on the production people. Once it's produced properly, what a fantastic moment! And you can imagine how it grabbed the people of the 19th century. But what do we have? One more break? All right, time for a quick break here. Well, I remember speaking of theatricality, of course, backstage at the opera, when an opera is being performed, is an experience that I don't think many people have had. And I will relate to you briefly what it's like. And I'm not discussing the mechanics either. I'm talking about the attitude of the performer toward the other performer. I remember standing in the wings with a great soprano while the second soprano was out on the stage singing her Musetta. And this girl was fabulous, the one that was out on the stage singing. And the great soprano stood next to me, and venom was pouring out of every pore. She was pacing back and forth like a tigress, back and forth, because this girl had the audience. The one out front had the audience right in the palm of her hand, and she was singing Musetta, that soft, faint, vaguely sad roll, and she was singing Musetta, and this great soprano kept pacing back and forth, swearing in 17 languages. Calamba! Asavanda! Cacarucha! And she's back and forth, and then her cue came. Boom! Out of the stage she went, her talons flashing, her eyes going, her cape swirling. In front of the other girl, she swept, and her voice rang out above and above, way up to the clouds, and she was in command. She had it all. And I stood back there and I said, yep, showbiz. All showbiz and a yard wide. Keep your knees loose, friend, or that tenor may outsing you any moment now in the opera. Look out for what's happening down in the shipping department. A great basso profundo is growing. Take over the whole crowd. An enormous Mephistopheles with a red, swirling, devilish cape. And the smell of brimstone is liable to devour us all.